This is In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro. The boycott of misogynist, racist, egotist Rush Limbaugh has had an absolutely stunning success. 40-some advertisers have pulled out, including even nonprofits asking that their free public service announcement don't run there. This hour, we probe into how such a unified response was achieved, what a long-term success looks like, and what this has in common with a heritage, including the Montgomery bus protest and the grape boycott. That's In Deep after the news. And helping us look at the news this time in our blogger spotlight, one of the most prominent bloggers in the progressive movement for, gosh, I don't know how long now, with the Brad blog, it's Brad Friedman. Brad, it's so good to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, Angie. How are you?
I'm fine. How many years has it been for the Brad blog?
I think we are now in our ninth year for some godforsaken reason.
It might have to do with the quality of what you put out, but I'm not.
Well, I was thinking it was because we haven't saved the world yet, so I guess we're still at it.
But maybe sometime next week. One thing you have been really consistent about covering is voter fraud, and we just had, you know, a little spate of elections, and I know that you've been very good at keeping your ear to the ground to see what's happening with voter registration laws, any evidence of voter fraud at the booths. How did this Super Tuesday come out? Pretty clean?
Well, let me say this. The greatest concern when it comes to elections is not actually voter fraud. It's election fraud. It's insiders, and it's the gaming of the system, removing people from the voting rolls, messing with the tabulators and the voting machines. So it's election fraud that is the biggest concern. Republicans like to pretend that voter fraud is a concern, but it's really not. When you have one insider who can change the results of an entire election on a computer tabulator, that's a serious concern. As far as Super Tuesday went, though, however, there are some interesting things beginning to emerge. And as always, it actually takes, because of the way we count our votes in secret with these computer tabulators, it actually takes sometimes days, sometimes weeks. And in some cases, as we saw recently in New York, it takes several years. New York Daily News just came out with a report showing that in the 2010 election, at some precincts up in the Bronx, some 70% of the paper ballots were mistallied by the ES&S OpScan systems they now use out there in New York.
How do you make a 70% error?
Because you use electronic voting systems that are basically crap. They're not tested. They don't work. We find over and over and over that they miscount ballots, that they don't count them at all, which is what is so maddening for me when I watch these election results come in, and you've got the media who, declares a winner and a loser within seconds after the polls close. Now, mind you, a lot of the times, they're not even bothering to use the computer tallied results. They're just using exit polls. Exit polls, as you recall, that we were told for years we should completely ignore because they're not accurate.
Right.
Remember that?
Uh-huh.
Back in 2004. Never mind that the exit poll showed that John Kerry should have won in swing state after swing state. Exit polls are always wrong. Ignore them. I guess they're wrong unless the media wants them to be right and wants them to, wants to use them to declare a winner or a loser within seconds after the polls close. So that's the sort of double standard that you got going on when it comes to election results. But then the results themselves simply cannot be trusted unless the citizens are able to oversee the actual paper ballots actually being counted, which is just not done in, most states anymore. There's very few places where we actually count the ballots in front of the public at the polling place before those ballots are moved anywhere.
If it's going to take weeks to get results anyway, why not do it that way?
Well, listen, it doesn't take weeks to get results when you hand count them at the precinct, at the polling place. For example, in New Hampshire, they still count them that way in some 40% of the towns, and many of those towns have their results in before the Diebold OpScan towns come in with their results. So it's a bit of a red herring to say that, this is going to take us a long time. If it takes a long time to count a couple hundred ballots, that probably means your precincts are too large and people are waiting in line to vote, and you should have smaller precincts. But what we're left with then, because you had asked about specifically about Super Tuesday, we're asked to, for example, I'm looking right here now at Lucas County, Ohio, where you had, this was one of the counties in the Congressional District 9 Democratic primary between Marcy Kaptur and Dennis Kucinich. Because they, you know, did some redistricting up there, and so they put these two progressives against each other. Well, I'm looking at the numbers in Lucas County, which is Toledo, Ohio, and there was about, I want to say about 24,000 votes. Looking at the election night results from the voting machines, and up there they happen to use 100% unverifiable touchscreen Diebold systems. From the Secretary of State's website, here's what they report. Marcy Kaptur had 22,269 votes. Dennis Kucinich had 870 votes.
Oh, come on.
That's with 100% of the precincts reporting. So that translates to 94% for Marcy Kaptur and 3.6% for Dennis Kucinich. Those are Saddam Hussein numbers.
And you know what? At that wonderful way to put that, we got to leave it there. But I thank you so much, Brad. I mean, how illustrative of the problems we've got. And I'm glad to have you back on the air with me. And we're going to do it again, definitely. Thank you so much.
Always great talking to you, Angie. Thanks for having me.
Brad Friedman with the Brad Blog. We'll put a link to him on our site. You find that at indeepradio.com. He's at the Brad Blog. I'm Angie Coiro. This is In Deep. It's In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro, and this is the part of the show where I normally give you all the background on our story of the day, but I practically don't have to on this one. Rush Limbaugh has been making an ass of himself on the airway for some time, but a very powerful man, and it behooves us to respect how powerful he is with a certain segment of society and way too much of Washington, D.C. He is, in fact, an honorary member of the Congress in Washington, D.C., as far as the Republicans are concerned. And it was his comments aimed first at a woman who attempted to address the Congress on the issue of birth control for women. She was disallowed. She was ultimately allowed to address the Democrats, who were willing to listen to her, while Daryl Issa, with his all-male committee, didn't see any reason to have her as part of the record. And Rush dismissed her as a slut and went forward to say that if she wanted to have her birth control paid for by the American public, which is an erroneous presentation, but we'll get to that later, then she should be willing to provide sex tapes in exchange. You've probably heard all that. What I hope you have heard as much of, and if not, I hope you fix that situation as quickly as you can, is there has been a very strong effort to get advertisers to pull their money and time from Rush Limbaugh. This has taken off at a level that I don't know if even the people behind it had begun to imagine. We're closing in on 40 advertisers who have said that they will no longer advertise with Rush Limbaugh. Amazingly, even the nonprofits who get free airtime, starting with Goodwill, quickly followed by the American Heart Association and others, started to say, please don't run our ads during Rush Limbaugh. This is notable because it's one thing for the people writing a check to have control over where their ads run. It's another thing for charities who are reliant on getting their messages out to as many people as possible and do not have the power of the checkbook behind it to actually get their spots pulled at their request or even to make that request because, of course, they are reliant upon the kindness of strangers. So let's analyze what's been happening with this boycott. And in the larger scheme of things, boycotts in general, their lifespan, how effective they are in the long term, which is something that's starting to edge into the media discourse about this. Let's start out this hour with a conversation with Angelo Carusone. He was famously known for a while in the Twitterverse and beyond as Stop Beck, and he is now the power behind Stop Rush. He's the director of online strategy for Media Matters for America. Angelo, good to talk to you again.
How are you?
I'm well.
It's nice to talk to you as well.
I first want to note one of your most recent triumphs, and that was Rush Limbaugh airing today. We record on Thursday for our weekend show. Rush Limbaugh airing today had 1 minute and 3 seconds of dead air at the end of one of his hours.
That's right. And you know, when we record our stream over the internet, so we record the internet stream for WABC in New York, which is one of the major stations there. And that's what we had. We had about a minute of dead air right at the end. There was a period of dead air earlier in the hour as well, so it was two examples of it. It was clean, so it wasn't the case that, you know, when it came back on, it was in the middle of a segment or in the middle of a commercial. We have been tracking the advertisements pretty regularly since March 1st, and we haven't had this occur before. We're not trying to overreach and say anything specific that, you know, this is that, but clearly it's something worth noting. We did have reports that the same thing happened over the air as well, over broadcast, over terrestrial radio. It sounded a little different on the terrestrial side. It went in, you know, it was like the commercial started, and then it cut out quickly, and then there was like 5 seconds of Rush randomly saying something, and then it was, you know, about 40 seconds or so of dead air there. And you know, as anyone in the radio business knows, that kind of dead air is like an eternity for you know, a broadcaster like that. So I don't have no idea what it means, to be honest. What I can say from behind the scenes, though, is that, you know, the advertisers that I talk to and the stations that I'm dealing with on a regular basis, you know, I know that they're struggling to fill their inventory. And as you noted in the lead-in to this show, even nonprofits, you know, even those public service announcements are asking that they not run during the program. And so I think that makes it a lot more complicated to fill the ads. I do know that in WABC, they were actually running, as of yesterday, they were giving their other advertisers free bonus ads during Rush Limbaugh. And many of those people that were receiving bonus ads, these are companies that pay, but they were just getting bonus ads on Rush Limbaugh. They were asking the station not to run the free ads for their company during Rush Limbaugh. So they're definitely struggling to fill the inventory, and I think the dead air is just indicative of that.
Angelo, we got the whole hour to talk to you, and I'm glad we do, and I do want to bring in our second voice, someone who's going to be a little more impartial because he is an academic looking at these at the situation through those eyes. Lawrence Glickman is chair of the Department of History at the University of South Carolina, and he's the author of Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. That's out from University of Chicago Press. And Lawrence, I believe that's coming out in paperback soon, is that right?
Yeah, it's coming out in paperback in July.
Great, great. I'm glad we're talking to you now then. Very timely. Let me ask, as someone who has studied the phenomenon of consumer activism, give me an idea of how this Rush boycott has played out in your eyes.
Well, it's very interesting historically because boycotts have been around since the American Revolution and are a very central part of our political culture. But there have been very few that I would put on par with this particular boycott because of the speed with which it's developed and because of the way it's entered the national political discourse. In the 20th century, the two boycotts, you think of most readily are probably the Montgomery bus boycott and the United Farm Workers Great Boycott. And this boycott, there have been obviously hundreds and indeed thousands of boycotts in the 21st century. And this one is shaping up as perhaps the most significant, even though we have had the boycott of the state of Arizona that took place a couple of years ago, and the boycott of Whole Foods and some other very significant boycotts. But this one seems to be taking not only economic but political form, and the way in which some of the most successful boycotts in our history have done.
Lawrence, one of the questions that I usually try to answer for our listeners is what historical lessons can we apply to what's happening today? And you mentioned the bus boycott and other historic boycotts. I wonder how many of those lessons are relevant anymore because so much has changed as to how boycotts are put together. Social media obviously was not a factor back in the time. Are there still lessons that persist from the earliest boycotts into today's, or is it a whole new game?
I think obviously the technology is different, but I think the lessons very much apply because the whole idea of the boycott is to create what I call in my book long-distance solidarity. That is, people who are not necessarily connected physically, but who have who draw a imagined community of supporters of a cause. And there's a, you know, there's a very long history of that, and it began with the telegraph and letters to the editor of newspapers and published pamphlets. It continued in the 20th century with radio and so forth, and now in the 21st century has been invigorated by the internet and social media, as you suggest. I would suggest that's made things faster, but it hasn't fundamentally changed what a boycott is and which ones work and which ones don't.
Well, Angelo, you have a much closer history with this, and you first came to my attention on Twitter as Stop Beck. And it was a very successful move to get advertisers off of the Glenn Beck show. he does still exist. He does still broadcast, but at a very different level of permeating the culture. Can you talk about how Beck started and where he is now? And then after this coming break, we're going to go into the details of how you did that.
Sure thing. I think that one thing I just want to note, though, is that, you know, we have mentioned the word boycott a few times, and I just want to just drill down there quickly because I think it'll help inform the discussion. And that's that when we say boycott, I think it's important to realize so far during this Rush Limbaugh stuff, the only player, the only entity that's actually boycotting are the actual companies, the advertisers themselves. They're boycotting Rush Limbaugh. There hasn't been a case yet where someone or the larger sort of movement has approached an advertiser, asked them to drop their ads, and then they refused, and then were subsequently boycotted as a result. I think that the risk of a consumer boycott is certainly what is driving these advertisers in part to act. But actually, so far, the only ones boycotting are the actual companies themselves. And in terms of Beck, and why I say that is because that was very much a part of what took place with Glenn Beck as well. That it was, you know, when we educated the advertisers and the business interests that were connected to Glenn Beck about not only his day-to-day, sort of the vitriol that was at place there, but actually really educated them about the business risks that flowed as a consequence of that. We saw that they made exactly what we expected them to do, a business decision. They made a calculus, they thought about it, and then they dropped him as a result. And so, you know, during that time period, it was an important part of ensuring that, you know, Mr. Beck's vitriol was not mainstreamed and legitimized by these, you know, very sort of prominent brands and companies in our society. And there's a separate question about what that means sort of generally, but I think if you're willing to be sort of wide-scale accepted for business, then in some ways there was a perverse incentive for Mr. Beck to continue to be as reckless and destructive and irresponsible as possible, because that in turn generates controversy. And a consumer-driven society, you can then turn that controversy sometimes into new business ventures. And so the underlying approach of the Beck work, and very much at place here, is to invert that model, to make sure that the bad kind of controversy can't be turned into additional profit, so that we're not incentivizing, you know, irresponsibility and recklessness. And I keep using this analogy like cholesterol. You know, there's like good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. It's kind of like that with controversy. For someone like Beck or Limbaugh, controversy can be turned into profit. Or it can be turned into, you know, into actually an opportunity for real, lasting accountability. And I think it just depends on how the actors move. And I think so far, in both situations, we've seen a very positive effort.
Angelo Carasone is Director of Online Strategy for Media Matters for America. Lawrence Glickman is with us as well from the University of South Carolina, where he chairs the Department of History. He's the author of Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. We're going to come right back in just a few moments. The gentlemen are with us throughout the show. I want you to hear a little bit of what Rush Limbaugh has been putting out over the airwaves, the kind of offensive things he's been spewing for years and is suddenly being held accountable for. I'm Angie Coiro. This is In Deep.
It makes her a slut, right? Makes her a prostitute. She wants to be paid to have sex. What would you call that woman? What would you call this? What would you call that? You'd call him a slut, a prostitute. This babe goes before Congress and wants thousands of dollars to pay for her sex. A woman goes up to congressional committee and says, I'm having sex so damn much, I'm going broke. 4 out of every 10 co-eds are having so much sex that it's hard to make ends meet. 4 out of every 10 co-eds are having so much sex. They're admitting before a congressional committee they're having so much sex they can't afford the birth control pills. Co-eds are having so much sex. So much sex. So much sex. So much sex at Georgetown. She's having so much sex.
With the Oxycontin. Made daddy mean. Wrapped a little bit.
You're listening to In Deep. I'm Angie Coro. If you're missing any portion of this show, we archive all of our shows at indeepradio.com, where you can also send us your guest and topic suggestions. That's indeepradio.com. A full archive of our shows available. We're talking about the boycott of Rush Limbaugh, which, as we learned in our last segment, is more of a boycott by the advertisers because of a threatened boycott by consumers. We get that education from Angelo Corsone, who is the Director of Online Strategy for Media Matters for America. Lawrence Glickman is the Chair of the Department of History at the University of South Carolina, who's been studying consumer activism for many years. Angelo Corsone, back to you. We were talking about how the Glenn Beck movement informed how you worked on the Stop Rush movement. Talk about the strategy to get yourself and your cause known. When you first got started, you didn't have a million Twitter followers. You didn't have any kind of a profile. How did you build the activism along with your own profile? What are the one, two, three steps there?
Well, I think the bottom line is persistence. Persistence pays off, and that's applicable not just to through any sort of accountability effort, but I think that's just generally applicable. And certainly that was one of the major ingredients. But there's something on top of that, and that's to be a constructive force here and to understand the reality of the environment in which we're living in. And so with respect to the Beck work, what was very clear there was that clearly he was getting a lot of attention, and that kind of, like I was talking about earlier, that kind of controversy, it sells, or at least it can sell. And so when sort of looking at the landscape, it's important to understand sort of the dynamics there, and that's that we live in our society is largely controlled by, our media is largely influenced by, a very large consolidation there. And so it's commercial driven. And that's not necessarily bad or good. I'm not evaluating that from a person. I'm not sort of ascribing any judgments there necessarily, but that's just the reality. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is when you sort of understand that, then you sort of are able to identify where the pressure points are. And that means that in a situation like in Beck's case, that would be News Corp, Roger Ailes, Rupert Murdoch, or in the case of Mr. Limbaugh, that would be Clear Channel. They're his employer. And so as a result of that, there's a certain responsibility there. If my employee is engaging in something that is reckless and irresponsible, and that's not to say that anything about the substance of the opinions, right? You can have a wide range of opinions that can be as, that can be as sort of controversial as you like, right? The thing is how you choose to use your platform to talk about those opinions, and you can do so in a responsible way or an irresponsible way. And there is a difference there. And so in the case of Mr. Beck, deliberate deceit and lying about people to the point where you would inspire violence against them, which is exactly what was happening, was irresponsible. And that doesn't mean he has to change his opinions, but it does mean that he had to act more responsibly. And since his employers weren't doing anything about it, the pressure point became the advertisers, because that was the very reason why Mr. Beck existed, which was to provide a show so that you could then sell inventory on an ad space. And the same thing applies here. And then what I did is just sort of overlaid that with the new reality that we live in, which is, in the past, Lawrence was talking about, sort of the other historical boycotts, and there were communities and structures that supported those individual efforts that provided for the organizing tools and the message and the mission behind them. And I think that one thing sort of generally in our society that has happened lately is, we've lost a lot of those civic structures. So things have become somewhat hollowed out, or they've been eliminated. And in place of them, as recently, has been the emergence of social media. And that's that it provides for cross-generational, cross-racial, and people interacting with each other in ways that they typically don't have an opportunity to, just as a result of our changing society. And so it's a really powerful organizing tool. And when you look at that, and then you look at the fact that many modern, very large companies spend an awful lot of their gross sort of income on marketing, there's a reason for that. It's important. It's important not just to make people aware of your product, but to really establish relationships with your consumers, your customers, potential customers, and the general public.
Well, now that has not really changed historically. You're bringing up some great points there, and it's been consistent throughout time that advertisers need to care about what their consumers think about them. Lawrence Glickman, one of the things that has changed, and I think tilts the picture of this a little bit, is, we heard Angelo mention News Corp and Rupert Murdoch. And we're talking about corporations that have more power and more money than ever before, more radio stations, more broadcast entities than they've ever been allowed to own before. And I wonder if this brings a little bit of imperviousness. Clear Channel, for example, is on record as saying that, you know, they're going to support Rush Limbaugh's ability to, you know, get his message out there. Armed Forces Radio Network says that they want a diversity of voices out there and a number of opinions, and that's why it's appropriate to keep Rush Limbaugh on there. When you're tilting at larger windmills, at larger corporations than ever before, how does that tilt the picture?
That's absolutely correct. These corporations are very powerful. That's why what I was suggesting before I think really applies in this case, which is that if you look throughout history, the most successful boycotts have had an economic element, which is, as Angela was just talking about, the threat of advertisers pulling out and also consumers not buying products that of the advertisers who continue to pay for Rush Limbaugh's programming. But in addition to that, there's been a way in which these boycotts have, the publicity around the boycotts have also raised consciousness about political issues. And so there's been kind of a two-pronged approach, which has been one economic and one political. And I think the real key here, and this kind of goes back to a point that the writer Naomi Klein made in her book No Logo, which is that as you get more powerful, more consolidated brands, they're also more vulnerable. And so I think Rush Limbaugh is a good example. Very, very powerful brand. Advertisers flock to him. Now advertisers seem to be running away. And if that brand is damaged, you know, as it has been, the question is whether it will be damaged in some sort of permanent basis. I could easily see a group like Armed Forces Radio, despite what they're saying today or yesterday, changing their mind within the next few weeks. And that's something that we can't know what will happen, but things are certainly pointing in a direction where there seems to be a lot more political pressure on Rush Limbaugh than there has been in the past, thanks to this advertiser pullout at this point. It could get a lot stronger, and individual consumers could get a lot more involved, as Angelo was suggesting. So I think it is true that we've got bigger and more powerful corporations, but in some ways, those brands are also more vulnerable.
Let me ask you this. Have we heard, Angelo, anything from Armed Forces Radio Network, any movement on their part? And are you concentrating, and by you I mean Media Matters and the whole team, are you concentrating on getting that Rush Limbaugh outlet to at least consider closing that door?
In terms of the Armed Forces Radio Network, what I think is, at least with respect to Media Matters' work, is, you know, what is notable about this Rush situation is that individual communities, individual constituencies, organizations, activists are organizing and speaking to their respective constituencies on issues that they think is going to motivate them best, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's an entire group out there in sort of the military world, which are troops and sort of and their family members who are making this request, and I think that they're the absolute best voice for that. And so the idea is, you know, what Media Matters' role, I think, is most effectively here is to continue to provide and be a credible and reliable source of information about Mr. Limbaugh's reckless vitriol and his misinformation and the consequences that flow from that. And in this particular unique situation, it's to also work with the advertisers. You know, one of the things that really is informing this is all the experience and work during the Beck work. And so, you know, the advertisers actually really do appreciate the work that we do. That's not just me talking. It's because we're not just out there bomb throwing. We're not dumping in advertisers incorrectly. We're giving folks heads up. We're giving them opportunities to sort of get out before it becomes public, especially knowing that many of them aren't doing it intentionally. You know, we're working with them to get them audio of where their ads are playing so that they can request those reimbursements and adjust their buys necessary, you know, as needed. And that's partly because there's so much individual organizing and taking place organically, that it's important to make sure that there's some sort of nexus of reliable information here. And I think that's definitely the best role that Media Matters can play right now. And sort of, you know, building on my experience and my work with the advertisers, I sure do know that they appreciate that, which is sort of a from my perspective, I think a rather interesting an interesting role to be in. You know, 3 years ago I was the bad guy for daring to talk to an advertiser, right? And now you see pieces out there where where, you know, actually it's quite the opposite, and the advertisers are actually beginning to realize, especially because for many of them, social media is still new and they haven't got a handle on it, that they can sort of help navigate this process with good information and with a reliable source. You know, if I go back and tell people, this advertiser is okay, you know, they did move their ads, move on, they will. And that's really important, not just for just the individual players involved, so people don't get hurt and companies don't get injured unnecessarily. But that's important for the credibility and the of the actual sort of large scale or individual these efforts, right? Mm-hmm. Because then people can look at it and say, all right, you know, they're being somewhat reasonable. You know, they're doing this the right way, and I think that's the best role. So I haven't heard any updates from Armed Forces Network. I'm obviously watching it, and I think the folks that are organizing there are making some pretty persuasive arguments, and I happily defer to what they think is best for themselves.
Angela Corazon with Media Matters for America. You're listening to In Deep Radio. I'm Angie Cuero, and we're talking about the art of the boycott. My other guest, Lawrence Glickman, who's with the University of South Carolina. And Lawrence, the title of one of your books brings this question to mind. That earlier book called Living Wage, American Workers and the Making of Consumer Society, that I haven't had the pleasure of reading the book, and I'll amend that. Believe me, I'll take care of that. But the vision of living wage, American workers, there was a time when the awareness of class distinction and the awareness of the power of the worker, both the potential and the realized, was much more in the forefront in American society. And this current boycott of Rush Limbaugh is taking place in an era where there's less awareness of unions, there's less approval of unions. And I'm kind of wondering about the lack of education of this kind of history in the mind of the people who are being asked to become activists. Let me give you an example. When you put out the information about what Rush Limbaugh has said, and when you put out the information you're trying to get his advertisers to weigh in to approve or disapprove, you'll often get the feedback that this is a free speech issue and Rush Limbaugh has the right to free speech. Even if you subtract the people who know that is not an accurate interpretation of free speech rights. No one's entitled to a radio show by the Constitution. I'm always struck by the lack of historic and, you know, civics awareness of those who really believe this is a free speech issue. So putting all that together, what I'm asking you is, are we today up against lack of education, lack of sophistication around issues of class, of worker strength, you know, the whole background that makes us understand the power of the boycott?
I think we absolutely are. One of the things that's happened really since the 1960s or 70s, and this is part of the new project I'm working on, is kind of on the history of conservative political discourse, especially around the idea of free enterprise, which is a term created in the 1930s as part of the revolt against the New Deal. One of the things that began slowly in that period and unsuccessfully through World War II into the 1950s, but began to take hold in the 1970s, was a alternative political story. It's one that we hear all the time today that really pushed our political spectrum to the right, in which unions were either demonized or seen as superfluous, in which ideas about the positive role of government were swept under the rug, in which what Reagan called our traditional free enterprise system was one in which government played no role. Now, that wasn't historically accurate, but I think a lot of younger people, in fact, a lot of older people today, that's the story they believe, because that's the story that's been purveyed to them by politicians, by the media for the most part, for quite some time. So I do think that history has a role to play in this. And one of the things that's interesting has been with this recent issue, which by the way does have class dimensions, but also with the Occupy Wall Street movement and so forth, what's been interesting has been a kind of counter movement and a counter narrative that seemed to be taking hold. And it's been interesting to watch at least some members of the Democratic Party beginning to connect up with this counter narrative, which in my view as a historian is more historically accurate about the role of government in American life and about the role of class in American life. So I do agree with you there, and I think that the idea of free speech that Limbaugh and his supporters are promoting is yet another example of kind of an inaccurate understanding of what that concept has meant historically.
Let me ask you to keep this answer brief because we're right up against the break. But staying with you, Lawrence, do you see this as a deliberate manipulation of the uneducated in some of these cases in pushing the idea that this is a free speech issue? Or is this something where people are just responsible for their own ignorance and no one's orchestrating it?
Right. I don't think it's deliberate. I don't think it's a deliberate attempt to confuse people. I think it just represents a misunderstanding of what free speech means in our history. And I think this is common. These misunderstandings, when they're not corrected for a very long time, as they weren't in our political discourse, they begin to take on the hold of mythology. And it becomes hard for people, who aren't necessarily experts in the area to come up with some sort of story that maybe challenges that narrative.
When we come back on the other side of this break, I'm going to take this question to Angelo Carosone because I know he'll have his own thoughts on the manipulation of the opinions around Rush Limbaugh, how much there is, and how much it just stems from pure ignorance. In the next hour, we're going to talk to an activist who goes by the name of Spocko, and Spocko is going to talk to us about activism beyond the boycott. One of the issues here is sustaining the power of what at the moment is a very big deal. Will it stay that way? I'll be back with Lawrence Glickman and Angelo Carosone in the next segment of In Deep.
So much sex, so much sex, so much sex, so much sex. She's having so much sex, it's amazing she can still walk. And her buddies with her. Maybe they're sex addicts. Does she have more boyfriends? They're lined up around the block. They want to have sex anytime. Has many partners as whatever. No limits on this. She and her co-ed classmates are having sex nearly three times a day for 3 years straight, apparently. $3,000 worth of birth control pills worth of sex. She's having sex so frequently that she can't afford all the birth control pills that she needs. We're talking sex addict frequency here. Thousands and thousands of dollars in taxpayer dollars to satisfy the sexual habits of female law students at Georgetown. I'm not questioning her virtue. I know what her virtue is. She's having so much sex that she's going broke. The woman who is happily presenting herself as an immoral, baseless, no purpose to her life woman. Here's a woman exercising no self-control. She wants to have repeated, never-ending, as often as she wants it sex. She wants a penalty-free, moral-free life where everybody else pays for the mistakes that she makes. She wants all the sex that she wants, so she's asking to be exempted from any personal responsibility. The woman wants unlimited, no responsibility, no consequence of sex. Ms. Fluke is asking to be exempted from personal responsibility. She wants to have sex without consequences, all the sex in the world, whenever she wants it, all the time, no consequences. Unlimited, no responsibility, no consequences sex. Unlimited, no consequences.
Like a sex machine, man. Yeah. Moving, doing it, you know. Yeah. Can I count it off? Yeah. One, two, three, four. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Wait a minute. Shake your arm. Then use your palm. Stay on the scene. Like a sex machine. You got to have the feeling. Sure as your bone. Get it together. Right on, right on. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
You got to get that. You give me fever and a cold sweat. The way I like it is the way it is. I got mine. Don't worry about his.
Get up.
machine. Get on up, get up, get on up, get up.
It's In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero. One more segment of conversation about the Rush Limbaugh boycott, what its success is likely to be in the long term, and what it reflects about how powerful we have become through social media and the other elements that have gone to bringing, say 40 or so advertisers in the ballpark. And those now include nonprofit advertisers who were getting a free ride on the Rush Limbaugh show, all of whom have decided that his rhetoric is too divisive and they don't want their name associated with his show. We have two guests on the line. Lawrence Glickman is with the University of South Carolina's Department of History. He's the author of Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. That's coming out in paperback in July. His earlier book, Living Wage, American Workers and the Making of Consumer Society. Angelo Carasone is on the line from Media Matters for America, where he's the director of online strategy. He is spearheading the move to Stop Rush, and he earlier spearheaded the move to Stop Beck. Angelo, when we left off, we were talking about the manipulation of messages from the right. I know this is a hard thing to put a percentage on. You can't say this, well, it's 30% manipulation and, 70% ignorance. If you could talk a little bit about how much deliberate manipulation goes on from behind the scenes.
I think that it's a fair amount. And certainly during the Beck stuff, that became very clear to me. And it's to a high degree. And it's not just, accidental. This is deliberate. This is well-calculated, well-crafted manipulation. And so you had that correct. And that obviously has consequences for us all, because we live in a free society that has many, there's real advantages of that. But that also, sort of requires a little bit of responsibility on the part of our fellow citizens. And so when you have, I think it's manipulation and deliberate on the part of the actors here, the responsible ones, whether it be the figures like Beck and Limbaugh or some of the underlying structures that support them, the commercial media behemoths, the News Corps of the world. But there's something else at play. It's that it's not just that they're manipulating them. It's that they prey on people's intuitions. If I'm someone already who's working pretty hard just to get by or barely get by or not get by, I when I turn on TV and I turn on something called news, I assume that it's going to be vetted, right? I assume that there might be opinions. There might be different perspectives, but that I'm not going to be out and out lied to. And I'm certainly not going to be out and out lied to on a repeated basis. And I certainly don't expect that it's being coordinated in such a manner to advance political and personal agendas. And I think that's where it becomes really problematic and pernicious. And I think in the example of Mr. Limbaugh, he's on over 600 stations. These are, and what's lost, and this sort of dovetails with some of the history that Lawrence was talking about earlier. I mean, those stations are public airwaves. Now, that's not to say that it has to be one opinion or another, but I think this concept of the commons has been lost in our society. That's one of the great strengths of America and living in a free society like we live in. And so when we start to lose that, then we don't feel the same connection to it, and we certainly don't get indignant when it's abused and used in the manner that it has been here. I mean, this guy is imposed on, because he has a big commercial media company backing him up, on communities, which crowds out diversity of voices, which actually ends up sort of chilling or at least limiting what is discussed on our public airwaves. And I think that's an underlying problem here. And so at the very least, I think if you're going to impose yourself to the extent that Mr. Limbaugh has been imposed on all these stations and all these communities, that you would at least use that power responsibly. And certainly there's been plenty of instances where he has not used that power responsibly. And I think that's in part what is motivating this action here. I think people are sort of done enduring the indignities and the consequences of his vitriol and deceit. And beyond that, I would add that I think one of the big barriers to acting and to participating is a sense of impotency, that doing something won't work. And I think that lately people are overcoming that sense of impotency. They think that, if I do participate in these things, I can achieve a desired result. And so I think there's been some clearing up of that and an overcoming of that barrier.
That's an interesting point you're bringing up, because I was listening to a presentation this morning about, of course, I'm recording this on Women's Day. And one of the issues I heard covered in a show that was talking about that was how many people are starting to hit the pavement for causes they really didn't feel they needed to get involved in. There are men who are marching on Women's Day today because of the attack on women's health rights. There are, you know, people who are willing to bring their children out when that would never have occurred to them before. But the issue of helplessness, Lawrence Glickman, also pokes its nose in here, because we're into, what, our second or third generation that really doesn't get the concept of this being the public's airwaves. You know, companies own stations. Companies sell out blocks of stations in hours and two-hour stretches to long infomercials. And when you have a behemoth of that size, and when you have that social and cultural understanding and acceptance that these airwaves are not yours, you know, how do you deal with that sense of powerlessness?
Yeah, that's a very big issue. I think, again, that's one of the reasons why I think that consumer activism has been such an appealing forum for Americans, because it's a way in which ordinary people feel like they can take a stand, they can have their voice heard, they can organize with other people, even people they might never meet or see, but who, through shared values, they can act collectively in some way. And it's also, I think, one of the reasons we're seeing a bit of a resurgence of popular protest, like with the Occupy movement, the events that happened in Wisconsin, on the UC campuses in California, and really all over the country, and indeed globally. And I think that while many of us have wish that the Occupy movement, for example, had a more coherent program for what they wanted to accomplish, I do think one of the great things about it has been that it's opened up space for that American tradition of dissent, which also goes back to our founding. Americans have a long tradition of public protest, and that's kind of one of the main political values that we share, is that we have the right to do that, and indeed sometimes the obligation to do that. I think when for a while there was a sense of a bit of complacency, and also a bit of a sense that there was really no way out for people who didn't like the status quo. But I think that's rapidly changing. I think the economic crisis is showing people that, you know, that times are pretty desperate for a lot of Americans. This crazy assault on birth control is obviously, I think, drawing a lot of ordinary people who might not have been involved otherwise in looking more closely and scrutinizing more closely the kind of things that not only Rush Limbaugh says, but that the Republican presidential candidates said in the debates as recently as a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. About the illegitimacy of birth control, and how birth control was, you know, the supposed libertarian Ron Paul was talking about how birth control was a symptom of a cultural crisis. That's pretty serious stuff. And I think when you hear that, you can't take your rights for granted. You have to realize that these need to be protected, and sometimes we need to go and do public, you know, activities in the public sphere to try to get our fellow citizens to see our point.
Well, Angelo, let's stay with this parallel to the rights that women have that are under attack right now. One of the key elements has been getting people to understand that even if they think this doesn't apply to them, women who are past childbearing age, women who don't need, you know, any kind of hormone manipulation, men who don't understand that birth control and other things are in fact an issue for them, that this does involve them, their sisters, their mothers, their dating relationship. How do we extend that kind of spreading the knowledge to people who think that whatever Rush Limbaugh says on the air is no business of theirs? Why should they care?
I mean, they should care for a couple of reasons. First, I think, and this gets to the free speech issue. You know, sometimes people bring that up, and I'm very sensitive to that. I mean, as somebody that pretty much sold my soul to go to law school, I don't like when people tell me that I'm destroying free speech, because I see it as actually quite the opposite of that. And I see it as quite the opposite. I mean, I understand what they're getting at. They don't want a chill speech. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to eliminate robust debates. And I get that value. But and this sort of gets into the issue here, which is that you don't protect free speech. You don't protect a culture that has robust debates and vigorous opinions by letting somebody that's on 600 stations with millions of people put 50 smears against a single individual person who does not have a counterbalance to push back against that. Because that not only chills that individual's speech by bullying them down into submission, or at least attempting to bully them down into submission, but it does something much more dangerous than that. It chills everybody else that would be willing to do a similar kind of thing. And so, from my perspective, I see this as, you know, if it pushing towards responsibility, at the very least, sort of advances that. And then it gets into the deeper issue, which is that how are we supposed to have a conversation where we start to understand each other, especially when it comes to understanding how policies affect women specifically? I mean, we certainly get plenty of that about how things affect men. And there's plenty of widespread social knowledge about that, but there's not about women. And I find it very interesting that the moment someone decides to step up and talk about this, or even just inform people how it affects their personal lives and those around them, that they're somehow a destructive force who is sent here from another planet, created just by communists who are here to infiltrate America and destroy it. When I actually think they're just trying to make our society function the way it was intended to. And I think that it's high time that people have a better understanding of that. And so I think that's at its core, that if you create the safe space for women to speak up and for men to listen, it certainly makes it a lot easier to get at the value that you were just doing. And so that's what I would boil this down to, that you can't have bullies like this around because they destroy the safe space that provides for the kind of communication that gets to the point that you'd like.
Oh,
and so
beautiful.
So that's my interest.
That is beautifully put.
Angie, can I just jump in on that?
Yeah, please, Lawrence, go ahead.
Yeah, one thing I want to add to that is I think this strikes me as a very important moment in American political history, because I think what Angelo is just getting at is that I think what's happened for a long time is that the right has corralled the idea of freedom, and freedom has been kind of their category. And I think what we're seeing now is that people on the other end of the political spectrum are saying, wait a minute, you know, a lot of what you're talking about doesn't really add up to freedom as far as I'm concerned. And freedom is not a right-wing value or necessarily a left-wing value, but it's something to be contested. And people who are trying to tell me what I can do with my body, and people who are saying that, you know, there's nothing that can be done if you're unemployed and can't find work and so forth, that doesn't strike a lot of Americans as really the essence of what freedom has meant historically. Here. I think this could be a very important turning point. I think it's been one of the weaknesses of the Democratic Party and the left overall, is that they haven't really been able to get a purchase on that idea of freedom, which seems so fundamentally American. And I think that seems to be reaching something of a tipping point in recent months.
With just a few minutes left in the show, I'd like to get both of your inputs on this. And that is the future of this boycott. First of all, Lawrence, I'd like to know from you, which boycotts in history have had sticking power? What we're hearing from a lot of the pundits is that the advertisers have gone into hiding. In the long term, no one is going to want to resist an audience of that size. They will come back. And even more so, there's the fact that Rush Limbaugh is rich beyond anyone's wildest dreams, and he can sit there without advertisers for as long as he wants. So ultimately, we may be seeing short-term success, but not really a long-term impact. Lawrence, what does history tell us about that?
Well, I think that history says that that's not necessarily the case, and I think the work that Angelo did with Glenn Beck is a good example of that, where Beck still has a platform, a much bigger platform than most of us, but I think he's not spoken of in the same way that he was even a year or two ago. He's been marginalized in the public arena to a much greater extent. I suspect that the same thing might well happen to Rush Limbaugh, who, you know, a lot of commentators have pointed out that in the past, any Republican who criticized Limbaugh had to immediately abjectly apologize to him. And that I don't think that necessarily would be the case anymore. And there are examples of boycotts throughout history that have really changed things for good. Of course, our founding American Revolutionary period was largely developed through a series of boycotts that took place up and down the Atlantic seaboard. The Montgomery bus boycott changed America forever. I think the United Farm Workers Great Boycott is another example of a boycott that had long-lasting effects, and again, not just economic, but political. Most boycotts, it's true, are evanescent. They disappear before they really take root, and it's impossible for any of us to say what will happen with this particular boycott. But I think things are pointing in a direction, and issues have been raised that I don't think can be swept under the rug so easily. I think a lot more people are aware now of the kinds of things that Rush Limbaugh has said. I mean, it's become much more a part of the public record, and a lot of people seem to be very offended by that and think that his right to free speech is one thing, but that we shouldn't necessarily be supporting advertisers who are paying for his voice to be heard on 600 radio stations around the country.
Angelo, we've only got about 2 minutes left, but if you could incorporate into your answer what the best case scenario is, what the best case scenario outcome for this current boycott is, and how you can sustain this level of success over time.
I think that Lawrence hit the nail on the head in terms of, you know, the sort of mitigating and blunting and neutralizing, you know, some of the effectiveness that Mr. Limbaugh had in the past. And so to that end, I think that there's been a lot of real success here already, and things that we can point to that will improve all of our communities. That said, I think just in terms of the lay of the land, you know, during the Beck work, nearly 400 advertisers had excluded their advertisements from appearing on Glenn Beck's program. During that time period, only two ever reneged. So I say that because I don't think that that's going to happen. I don't think that companies are going to come back here. These policies are not just, very wishy-washy. A lot of these are coming out and strongly condemning them. And I think what's important is that to understand the dynamic here. Mr. Limbaugh is on Clear Channel, which has a lot of stations, but they also rely on affiliates. Those are stations owned by other companies, either small broadcasters or medium-sized broadcasting companies or what have you. But those companies now, when a national brand with local advertisements makes a policy, like, say, Sears, for instance, or JCPenney, say, no more ads on Rush Limbaugh, that applies to every single one of those stations. And someone there has to make sure that they don't cycle in these excluded ads from their inventory in order so that they don't run these ads in error. And that has a real effect on the local stations and the affiliates. It has a real effect on their day-to-day operations. It has a real effect on their bottom lines. And just like these advertisers had to ask themselves the question, is Rush Limbaugh good for my business? And they've all said no. So at some point, these affiliates are going to have to ask themselves the same question. Is Rush Limbaugh good for my business? And the answer is going to be no. That's what we saw at the Beck work. And I think that'll become very clear here. And ultimately, that's a good thing, because as they start to drop them, we've already seen two that have done that, two affiliate stations, that increases diversity in the media. They'll have to hire someone who previously probably used to be a local person there who had a show from 12 to 3 who lost it so that Rush Limbaugh could pick up another station. And you know, you're right, he has a lot of money. That's why that's why it takes so much effort even to get the tiniest crumb of accountability from these behemoths.
Angelo, I got to interrupt you there because we're up against the clock, but you both have been brilliant guests, and I really appreciate giving me your time. Angelo Carasone is the Director of Online Strategy for Media Matters for America. We'll be putting links up to his work at our website, indeepradio.com. Likewise for Lawrence Glickman, who is the Chair of the Department of History at the University of South Carolina and author of the book about to come out in paperback, Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. I'm Angie Coiro, and this is In Deep. Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep, which is a production of Live from the Left Coast. You can get more information on the show and our company at lftlc.com. Live from the Left Coast. While you're there, you can become a member and support our work. We have a separate website for the show that is indeep.org. If you have any questions or feedback, there's a contact button right there, indeep.org. We are developing a recurring series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy. And you're a big part of that. We'd like your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions. Send them in via our website, the contact button at indeep.org. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Coiro. Thanks, and we will see you then. You're listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.